Hello, friends, and welcome to this episode of the Clone Conspiracy Podcast, the show where we try to get to the bottom of just what the hell was going on with Spider-Man comics in the mid-90s. I'm your host and guide, Scott Free, and I want to thank you again for the monumental mistake of joining me on this journey through one of the most infamous stories and periods in Marvel Comics history, the Clone Saga, and, of course, the story of Spider-Man's clone, Ben Reilly. On this episode, we're taking a trip back to the 1970s. Now, you're probably saying to yourself, Scott, doesn't the Clone Saga happen in the 90s? Isn't it all about 90s angst? Ben brooding on the rooftop of a coffee shop in the village in the rain while the Goo Goo Dolls' Iris plays softly in the background? Well, yes and no. The all caps Clone Saga, the famous one or infamous one, does take place in the 90s, from a period ranging from 1994 through late 96 or early 97. But that's technically the second Clone Saga. And to get there, we have to go back and start in the 1970s with the original Clone Saga, often referred to as the First Clone Saga or the 70s Clone Saga, to distinguish it from the Clone Saga. Now, this episode is going to be a lot of backstory on what was going on in the 70s, and I assure you, it will make sense in the end. So picture it. It's New York, it's 1973. Jerry Conway is 21 years old, and the recently appointed writer of Amazing Spider-Man. He succeeded Stan Lee, starting with issue 111 in 1971, at the age of 20. And prior to that, he'd been doing scripts under Stan Lee. So Conway arguably starts on Spider-Man in the early 100s, but he is the sole writer by issue 111, 1971. Peter Parker is, by this point, in college. As a sidebar, this is one of my huge pet peeves. He hasn't actually been in high school since 1965. He graduates in Amazing Spider-Man 28, by the way. Despite what adaptations would have you believe, Peter's time as a high school student is actually a really tiny part of the broader Spider-Man story. It's 28 issues. Ditko is still even on the book with Stan Lee when he graduates. His time in high school is actually really short publication-wise, and a lot of the characters who in media adaptations, such as Insomniac's Spider-Man games, or various cartoons, or the films, don't actually appear until he's out of high school. You know, some of his supporting characters in high school are like Flash Thompson, but Gwen Stacy and Harry Osborn don't appear until after. So Peter starts college in 1965's issue 31. He starts at Empire State University. This is Marvel stand-in for NYU. It appears across Marvel publications. This is Reed Richards' alma mater. Various other characters attend ESU. It's convenient, it's easy, it's an easy stand-in, it's in the city, boom. As I said, he starts college in issue 31. This is also the issue that marks the first appearance of Gwen Stacy and Harry Osborn. It also marks the first appearance of ESU biology professor Miles Warren. You will hear a lot more, probably more than you ever wanted to know, about Miles Warren as this podcast goes on. He is, of course, the villain and antagonist of the Clone Saga, the Jackal. But at this point, 1965, He's just plain Miles Warren. So Peter, during his college years, he has a stable and long-running cast of supporting characters, including, of course, Aunt May, who never goes away, his best friend Harry Osborn, and Harry's on-again, off-again girlfriend, Mary Jane Watson. She and Harry were a couple. It's confusing. And, of course, Peter's love interest, Gwen Stacy. Now, dating comic book eras is an arbitrary exercise. As comics readers, as writers, commentators, historians, what have you, we can point to certain events and issues that mark a change in eras. The golden age of superhero comics arguably, and I would say definitively, begins in 1938 with the debut of Superman in Action Comics number one. There are, of course, DC stories going back to 1935, the introduction of characters like Dr. Occult or Slam Bradley in the pre-Batman Detective Comics, issue 1 through 26, but what we think of as the Golden Age proper begins with the debut of Superman in 1938. The Silver Age, similarly, can be said to begin overall with the debut of Barry Allen as the Flash in 1956 in Showcase number 4 over at DC, and at Marvel, you can definitely date the start of the Silver Age to the debut of the Fantastic Four and Fantastic Four number 1 in 1961. As I mentioned before, by the early 70s, Jerry Conway has taken over Amazing Spider-Man with issue 111, and his storytelling starts to move Spider-Man comics in a more mature direction. In June 1973, Marvel publishes Spider-Man 121. This is a very famous comic titled The Night Gwen Stacy Died. It's written by Conway with John Romita Sr. and Gil Kane on art. Whether this issue is the precise point that Marvel's Silver Age ends is, again, sort of an arbitrary exercise, an arbitrary debate, but this is often held up as the definitive break with the lighter storytelling of the Lee Silver Age and the start of a deeper, more mature Bronze Age storytelling at Marvel. This mirrors, for example, broader industry trends. Again, if you look over at DC, this is Denny O'Neil's darker take on Batman is occurring sort of simultaneously, where he introduces characters like Ra's al Ghul and moves away from sort of the camp of the Silver Age 60s, the Adam West series, and all of that, in favor of a return to Batman's sort of darker, grittier roots. And again, we see this over at Marvel in sort of this era, which will continue on through, you know, the introduction of the Giant Size X-Men, the reboot of the X-Men franchise, and Giant Size X-Men number one in 1975, and then the start of sort of the Claremont run and all of that. But this particular issue, The Night Gwen Stacy Died, is sort of a good point if you're trying to determine when does Marvel Silver Age end, when does the Bronze Age proper begin. And I would argue that this is the issue. And I said, this is a famous comic. It's arguably one of the most famous Spider-Man comics. It's revisited constantly. It's revisited and referenced in other works to the point of that a lot of fans who might be familiar with the story, for example, from various adaptations or subsequent retellings, have never actually read the actual issue. And it occurs in the middle of a couple of long-running plot lines, which is, to give you sort of the background on this, Harry Osborn has developed a drug problem, LSD. He has supposedly overdosed on LSD and is in a coma. Norman Osborn, his father, who I should note does know Peter's identity, he's been partially amnesiac, and the Green Goblin persona has been repressed for quite a bit at this point, actually. The Green Goblin's sort of been off the stage as a major player, but the trauma of Harry's near death causes Norman's mental barriers to start to break down, and there's beautiful spread, terrifying, but beautiful spread done by Mita, where you see Norman having a breakdown and the goblin persona reasserting itself when confronted with this trauma. So he snaps. That's what Norman does. Norman snaps. He has a mental breakdown. That's his shtick. Get used to it. The goblin comes roaring back. Norman, who was aware of Peter's secret identity, but as part of the amnesia, had forgotten it, is once again aware. He blames Spider-Man and, by extension, Peter for Harry's misfortune through various things that happened in the plot. And Norman kidnaps Gwen. Luring Peter up to the George Washington Bridge in the story, it's later retconned to the Brooklyn Bridge, because when you read the story, if you're familiar at all with New York, geographically, they're clearly fighting on the Brooklyn Bridge. It's the design of the Brooklyn Bridge, not the George Washington Bridge. But anyway, it's a whole thing, I'm not going to get into it, but you can argue with nerds for days on the internet about which bridge Gwen Stacy got yeeted off of. Peter and Norman fight. They fight across the bridge. Norman strikes Gwen, and she falls off the bridge. Peter snags her with a web, arresting her momentum, but there's a very visual on-panel jerk as she stops, and there's a snap noise. Gwen is dead. And in the next issue, 122, Norman appears to die fighting Peter, accidentally being impaled on his glider. Marvel cleverly gets around the comics code restrictions by showing that Norman accidentally impales himself. Peter doesn't do it. And it's actually pretty gruesome death for a Marvel comic in this era, but they're able to get away with showing it by portraying, oh, dies graphically. This is sort of like the wages of Norman's sins. Like, he's brought this almost on himself, and he gets impaled, and he supposedly dies. The snap sound effect on the panel has been a point of contention for decades, and Marvel have gone back and forth on whether it was the sudden deceleration that killed Gwen, or if it was Norman's blow knocking her off the bridge that did it. Now, Roy Thomas, the editor, Roy the Boy, who, if you have read any sort of Marvel comics from the late 60s through really the 80s, some stuff in the 90s, Roy Thomas is a massive figure in Marvel history. It's very difficult to talk about this era of Marvel without talking about Roy Thomas to some extent. Now, Roy Thomas, answering letters in Amazing Spider-Man 125, pointed to the webbing whiplash as the cause of Gwen's death, whereas other Marvel works, such as 1987's Official Marvel Handbook, point to Norman's blow and the fall as killing Gwen. And it's a recurring thing in story as well. Peter has guilt over Gwen's death after the death of Uncle Ben. This is the sort of second great death in Spider-Man's life and career. The death of Gwen is something that will stick with Peter for the rest of his life. Either way, at the end of 121 through 122, Gwen is dead. Norman, also dead. The backlash behind the scenes, editorially, was intense. In interviews years later, John Romita Sr., who I'm just going to call Romita for the rest of this episode and the next one, so just keep in mind that I'm talking about John Romita Sr., and not his son, John Romita Jr., who is another iconic Marvel artist who worked very heavily on Spider-Man and then on X-Men books in the 80s. Talking about Sr. here. Interviews years later, Romita would recall that Marvel received some death threats, actually, after Amazing Spider-Man 121, with people out for Jerry Conway and his blood, which just shows you that comics fans, and Spider-Man fans in particular, have always been very healthy and stable people. But behind the scenes at Marvel, Gwen's death was contentious. Per Conway and, again, Romita, editorial had originally pitched killing off Aunt May in the story. Both Conway and Romita pushed back against that, and they argued against killing May, feeling that it would cut Peter off from the last bits of his childhood. Instead, and again this is per John Romita, they felt that the death should happen to either Mary Jane Watson or to Gwen Stacy. Both Conway and Romita found MJ to be a much more interesting character to work with. On the writing side, she's a dynamic personality, she's a really snappy patter, she's a lot more comedic moments than Gwen, and on the design point, she's extremely fashionable. You can draw Mary Jane in a ton of different outfits, and it's great. Gwen, while not unfashionable, was just a much less interesting character. She's much more of a traditional 2D Silver Age love interest, and sort of a contrast to MJ, who is a character with a much more dynamic personality that fits with sort of the Bronze Age darker tone that the books are starting to transition to. So they both agreed, Conway and Romita, that killing Gwen would be the better choice, and Gwendy, as Peter calls her, got the chop. Editorial, led by Roy Thomas again, then subsequently shot down having Gwen miraculously survive. Once the letters started to come in and they realized that fans were really pissed off about this death, there was some pushback internally to having the death be permanent. But Roy Thomas, to give him credit, really pushed back. Even Stan Lee, who had originally given his blessing to the death, then went on vacation, came back, and found out that people were really pissed off about this. Even Stan Lee tried to get them to reverse it, but Conway and Thomas stood their ground, arguing that bringing Gwen back permanently would be a cheap stunt that lessened the impact of the death and the whole point of the story that they were trying to tell. But it does seem that, like, all this talk about Gwen Stacy surviving gave Jerry Conway some ideas. As readers would find out much, much later, Peter and Gwen's college biology professor, Miles Warren, later the Jackal, was actually in love with Gwen Stacy. Perhaps his love was fatherly, perhaps it was intensely, creepily romantic. I tend to go in the later direction because it is super creepy. Either way, Warren, who to this point had been sort of a third-tier supporting character since his introduction in 1965's Amazing Spider-Man 31, swore revenge and would stop at nothing to bring his, air quotes, Gwen back. And that, webheads, is where we end the first part of this two-part jaunt to the 1970s, with the end of the Silver Age. Next episode, we're going to talk about the debut of the Punisher, the proper debut of the Jackal, and the first appearance of Ben Reilly as we discuss the first Clone Saga. I am, once again, Scott Free. Check us out on Instagram at the Clone Conspiracy Podcast, and also my personal page, Scott Free, and I will see you next time.